Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Thursday, June 4th. Today is the anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre of pro-democracy demonstrators in China. It was on this date, June 4th in 1989. Let's hope that President Trump doesn't decide to make Lafayette Square across from the White House his Tiananmen Square. The way he's been going, he would do it if he thought it would help him get reelected, or so it seems. At least we can say that polls that are coming out indicate the opposite is true. It would not help him. Trump is sinking in some key swing states. Even Texas is a statistical tie now between him and Biden in a new poll as he continues to manage both the pandemic and the uprising in his way. Former President George W. Bush, did you hear this, wrote in a statement Tuesday that he and his wife, Laura, were, quote, disturbed by the injustice and fear that suffocate our country, unquote, and that they should be viewed, quote, through the eyes of the threatened, oppressed, and disenfranchised. George W. Bush wrote that. And in what looks like a rebuke of Trump, without using his name, Bush also wrote, there is a better way, the way of empathy and shared commitment and bold action and a peace rooted in justice. George W. Bush. And there has rarely been a more remarkable break with a president in United States history than the one yesterday by Trump's original defense secretary, James Mattis. Let's turn back the clock to December 2016, shortly after Trump's election, when he was all pumped up at a rally about the guy he was appointing to lead the military, in no small measure because of his nickname.
I'm proud to formally announce today my intention to nominate General James Mad Dog Mattis as the next Secretary of Defense for the United States of America.
And listen carefully to what that mad dog said when he took the stage.
I'm grateful for the opportunity to return to our troops, their families, the civilians of the Department of Defense, because I know how committed they are and devoted they are to the defense of our country, the defense of our Constitution.
The defense of our Constitution. Well, yesterday, that mad dog, who turns out to be very sane, published a major rebuke of the president in The Atlantic. I'm sure you've heard that this happened. It only exists in print so far. So forgive me for reading an extended excerpt of this. If you've only heard the headlines, it's really worth hearing some of Mattis's words. He writes, I have watched this week's unfolding events angry and appalled. The words equal justice under law are carved in the pediment of the United States Supreme Court. This is precisely what protesters are rightly demanding. It is a wholesome and unifying demand, one that all of us should be able to get behind. We must not be distracted by a small number of lawbreakers. The protests are defined by tens of thousands of people of conscience who are insisting that we live up to our values as people and our values as a nation. When I joined the military some 50 years ago, I swore an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Never did I dream that troops taking that same oath would be ordered under any circumstance to violate the constitutional rights of their fellow citizens, much less to provide a bizarre photo op for the elected commander-in-chief with military leadership standing alongside. And of course, he was referring to that photo op that Trump staged Monday with troops using tear gas to clear peaceful protesters so the president could walk a path to a church and hold up a Bible as a prop, like a trophy, as if he had won a race or a battle. Here's more from General Mattis's written statement. Donald Trump is the first president in my lifetime who does not try to unite the American people, does not even pretend to try. Instead, he tries to divide us. We are witnessing the consequences of 3 years of this deliberate effort. We are witnessing the consequences of 3 years without mature leadership. We can unite without him, drawing on the strengths inherent in our civil society. This will not be easy, as the past few days have shown, but we owe it to our fellow citizens, to past generations that bled to defend our promise, and to our children. We can come through this trying time stronger and with a renewed sense of purpose and respect for one another. The pandemic has shown us that it is not only our troops who are willing to offer the ultimate sacrifice for the safety of the community, Americans in hospitals, grocery stores, post offices, and elsewhere have put their lives on the line in order to serve their fellow citizens and their country. We know that we are better than the abuse of executive authority that we witnessed in Lafayette Square. We must reject and hold accountable those in office who would make a mockery of our Constitution. At the same time, we must remember Lincoln's better angels and listen to them as we work to unite. The words of former Defense Secretary James Mattis in The Atlantic. With me now, Washington Post political reporter and the host of Washington Week on PBS, Robert Costa. Hi, Robert. Thank you for making such some time for us on such an intense day in Washington when I know you're extremely busy. Welcome back to WNYC.
It's great to be with you, Brian.
Who do you get the sense Mattis is writing for or hopes to influence by coming out the way he did?
He's speaking directly to Secretary Esper, to General Milley, the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. This is a message that's not necessarily meant for the public, though he, of course, wants it to be read by millions of Americans, but it's meant to people on the inside. I covered Secretary Mattis as a White House reporter when he was in the administration, and this is someone who is always askew doing TV interviews or being a fixture on the Sunday morning circuit. He really does, to your point, believe in the Constitution. And he said that at the top of his remarks when he was introduced as the nominee for Secretary of Defense. And to this day, he is one of those people who we would always write about who saw the norms of America being tested by this president and thought his role was to try to preserve the rule of law. He has been criticized for not doing enough while he was inside, for not saying enough when he has been outside. But he always feels like he's trying to navigate being both an American who has an obligation to speak out, but also an official who does not want to be a political figure disrupting the government.
Would it matter more, Robert, politically, if current Republicans, not just retired ones like Mattis and Bush, were to say things like they are saying?
That's an important point, Brian, because as a reporter who's at the Capitol all the time, you get the sense that Republicans are appreciative of people like General Mattis, but they don't take their cues from General Mattis. They will feel uncomfortable about what he's written in The Atlantic, but they have always seen the military, especially the upper brass of the military, generally speaking, as more center-left or center-right, not necessarily Republican, and they don't feel pressure at this moment, just months ahead of the election, to suddenly change their tune on President Trump, on American democracy. In fact, many Republicans from Senator Cotton of Arkansas and others are encouraging the president as he stokes a military response to the protests. And they believe that this law and order message that President Trump is articulating, this rally cry, is something that they too should adopt if they want to win election again and to hold power.
Because if they don't stand with Trump, then they might as well be Democrats, and then the voters in their states might as well elect a real Democrat?
And they also believe that their voters, that core Republican Trump voter, is not suddenly having a reckoning about this country, about race, because of the George Floyd tragedy. And that's their calculus. I'm making phone calls every day trying to figure out, are there cracks? And there are not cracks at this moment with President Trump, with Republicans. Casey Hunt of NBC News showed all the images of the Republicans on Tuesday walking into lunch all quiet as they face pretty tough questions about this.
There was also the matter of the current defense secretary, Mark Esper, sort of breaking with Trump yesterday. Esper said this.
The option to use active duty forces in a law enforcement role should only be used as a matter of last resort and only in the most urgent and dire of situations. We are not in one of those situations now. I do not support invoking the Insurrection Act.
So, Robert, could you explain those terms that have been in the news around this? Active duty forces in a law enforcement role, what's the distinction there, and what's the Insurrection Act?
So, in brief, the United States of America comes down to the point where we have a federal military, but it's governors running states who decide the scope and involvement of the military in their respective states. And that comes back to the idea that's called posse comitatus, where the National Guard is called up only with the explicit approval of the governors. And it's part of this fragile balance, this dance, a democratic dance between the federal government and states when it comes to power, when it comes to militarization. But the federal government, the executive branch, does have this other card they can play legally, the Insurrection Act, which means you can essentially go around the idea of posse comitatus, go around the idea of governors having control of their National Guard. And for national security reasons or other reasons, you argue, you can send the military into states if it's a dire threat to the country. And that's what the president's talking about when he uses the phrase Insurrection Act, is the idea of sending in the military to cities even if governors do not want the military in those states. And it's a test of American democracy. This is going to be studied for years by historians, because you have states like Virginia, where Governor Northam, a Democrat, is resisting sending his own National Guard now to Washington, D.C., discomforted by how the president's handling the militarization. Yet you have the Attorney General of the United States, Bill Barr, using federal prison correctional officers to help guard the streets of Washington, D.C. A lot of blurred lines, not only politically, but legally and constitutionally.
Lloyd in Newark, you're on WNYC. Lloyd, thank you for calling in. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I just want to loan my opinion for whatever it's worth and however it resonates with anyone else or doesn't. I think police departments are already quasi-militarized. They use surplus Department of Defense equipment as it is. And many police officers, I understand, are veterans themselves. But here's my take on it.
And you too, by the way, just for context, since we were inviting vets, are you also a vet?
I served as a reservist from 84 to 86, and then active duty 86 to 92.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And so my further point is to psychologically gear up to go into combat or defend your country against a foreign enemy is much easier than doing it on your own soil with your fellow, against your fellow Americans. And then it brings to mind that old song, and I don't know the title of it, but it starts off with, I'm proud to be an American where at least I know I'm free. I mean, what's going on here? There's just too much confusion. It doesn't make sense. And you already have well-budgeted police departments. If they can't do the job, then disband them.
Lloyd, thank you very much for chiming in. Another veteran calling in. Lisa in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Lisa, thank you so much. Hi.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for your service. I get that a lot. I'm a 21-year veteran of the United States Navy. I left active duty. I retired in 2011. And to the previous caller's point, we need more Captain Croziers willing to advocate to the risk of their career. And I know that's a hard ask, but willing to advocate on behalf of their troops, willing to stand up to the power brokers who control their deployments, their movements, and their lives while in uniform. And it's become abundantly clear that allegiance to the Constitution is diametrically opposed to allegiance to the sitting president. And to those honorably serving the country, to the leadership from the Joint Chiefs down to the company commanders, to the squad leaders, even down to the small unit fire team leaders, you don't want to be on the wrong side of history, because that would be even more lethal than this coronavirus. You may survive the virus, but you won't survive being on the wrong side of this history. And leadership isn't just about the wardrobe you choose, the uniform that you're in. To all the currently those that are currently serving the administration, unless you're willing to say no in uniform or in a suit, stop deluding yourself that you're helping. You're part of the problem, you're the enablers, and you're the collaborators.
Lisa, thank you for your service and for your call. Roland in Washington, D.C., you're on WNYC. Hello, Roland.
Hi, how are you doing, Brian?
I'm all right.
I serve part of I'm a former Army officer, and I served part of my time in the U.S. Army Recruiting Command. And I can tell you, in an all-volunteer military, it is a tremendous problem for the sergeants and officers who work for me to go into a neighborhood to try to recruit good qualified minority candidates when their memory is of tanks and armored personnel carriers rolling down the street. And I think that what's being lost here is that it's damaging the image of the Army that I served in. And that's a real long-term problem that will exist long after this period of civil disobedience is over.
So for you as a vet and a recruiting officer, thank you for your service. Thank you so much for your call, Roland.
Keep up the good work. Thank you.
Robert Costa, well, thinking anything after that set of calls?
You just listen to those voices who called in, people who have served this country, and you realize that we're at an unbelievable moment. And I try to step back as a reporter sometimes and just try to process it all. They're trying to process it all as people who are committed to this country, serving this country. There's not only racial strife on the streets, a major debate about the militarization of the federal response. You have an ongoing pandemic that's affecting millions of Americans who are still out of work, affecting communities of color in unprecedented and terrible ways. And it's a storm. It's a storm out there in the country. And you see the military leaders, military personnel, from rank and file members to the upper leadership, all trying to stay calm and stay steady. And you don't see or hear in their voices hysteria. You do hear some anger, but you don't hear hysteria. And I think we could all take something from them, at least, in the way that they're trying to judiciously approach a very delicate juncture in American life.
Robert Costa from The Washington Post and Washington Week on PBS for another few minutes. Then Mara Gay from The New York Times editorial board. Robert, as Mattis was writing in The Atlantic, the president did get an allied op-ed in The New York Times by Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton, as you know. For people who don't know, I think it's fair to say he's one of the most Trumpy senators in general, if not the most. The op-ed was actually titled, Send in the Troops. And here are a few lines. The pace of looting and disorder may fluctuate from night to night, but it's past time to support local law enforcement with federal authority. Some governors have mobilized the National Guard, yet others refuse, and in some cases, the rioters, as he calls them, still outnumber the police and guard combined. In these circumstances, the Insurrection Act authorizes the president to employ the military, quote, or any other means in cases of insurrection or obstruction to the laws, unquote. This venerable law, he writes, nearly as old as our republic itself, doesn't amount to martial law or the end of democracy, as some excitable critics, ignorant of both the law and our history, have comically suggested, unquote. So, Robert, who's Tom Cotton's audience?
Tom Cotton's audience is President Trump, and it's a sign of solidarity. But there are real issues with some of the statements in this op-ed. As a reporter, you read a line like there are cadres of, quote, left-wing radicals like Antifa that are infiltrating protest marches. It's a statement that's been debunked in the New York Times as misinformation and by other publications. And we don't have data on these protests in any way that shows that these are somehow left-wing radical-controlled protests. The images, the reporting bears out protests that are widespread and mostly peaceful. There has been looting in some cities, no doubt about it. But these are peaceful protests. And in Lafayette Square in particular, you had the federal government taking a provocative act of pushing people back quickly. But Senator Cotton, his audience is President Trump. It's also his constituents in Arkansas. And there is a competition, let's not forget, already afoot for 2024. Who is going to be the heir of Trumpism? If President Trump loses or wins again, you're going to see some people try to break away from his brand, but others will try to carry the torch. And Senator Cotton, with this op-ed, is effectively saying, I am here with President Trump, taking a stand, agreeing with his militarization.
Robert Costa from The Washington Post and the host of Washington Week on PBS. Robert, I can't fit all the things we want to talk about these days into a two-hour show. I don't know how you're going to do it on Washington Week tomorrow night, but somehow you're going to do it.
We'll do our best. Just like you, we only have so much time, and there is so much to talk about. Sometimes I wish I could be like Ken Burns and have 8 to 10 hours.
Robert, thanks so much for making some time today.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is obviously also a daily coronavirus podcast under the circumstances in our country right now. We'll keep staying on top of things to serve you the best we can. And remember, this podcast is excerpted from my live weekday call-in show, The Brian Lehrer Show. If you want to be a caller or just hear it live, it's from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time on WNYC Radio in New York, or online at WNYC.org. You can also tweet a question at us anytime. Just tweet at Brian Lehrer. Thanks for listening today.